Hey Podnuts, Corey here from Instant House Call. Whether you're a break fix tech who needs to provide remote support on demand without pre-installed software, or a managed service provider who wants to connect to unattended PCs anytime, Instant House Call makes remote support easy. I want to invite you to try Instant House Call free for yourself. Go to podnuts.com and click on the link in the show notes, then use the promo code PODNUTS. Instant House Call is the best remote support on earth. We can prove it. Try it free now and see for yourself.
Welcome to PodNuts Daily, episode number 424, a show for computer repair techs by computer repair techs. I'm your host, Jeff Halish. I'm joined today by Alex Shimandy from Invescent.com. How are you doing, Alex?
I'm doing well, Jeff. It is a pleasure to be here. How are you doing?
I am doing excellent. It is. I love talking about tech, and I love talking about tech with other techs. It makes it much more interesting.
It's a lot of fun, right? And you guys have an amazing service that you're providing to the tech community here. It's really valuable because you're going to so many different areas of tech, and you're providing this service with a wide variety of guests, and it's free. And there's so much value here. I can't begin to thank you enough.
Oh, well, I definitely appreciate that. This is why we do it, you know, for everybody out in the industry, because I think we're definitely in a niche field, and it's nice to have something that you can go to. I know back in the day when I listened to this show right from the beginning, and I always picked up somebody or something from a new tech, an old tech. It didn't matter. I picked up, you know, some little piece of information that I could put in my own business, and it's helped me. So that's why I want to give back, and that's why we do it.
It's amazing.
Very cool. All right. Well, let's do this. Why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself and basically, you know, maybe where you're from and how you got started in computer repair.
Sure. Well, I'm from the Washington, D.C. area. I'll tell you how I got started with computers, and then we can work my way into tech. I got my first computer when I was 5 years old. It was a Commodore 64 128, and probably still to this day, one of my favorite computers. Oh, but yeah. I mean, it's just a great machine, right?
Yep.
And I learned how to take it apart, put it together, you know, program BASIC and stuff like that. And I knew immediately from that point that technology was my passion. And so then I got my first job doing internet tech support at age 15. It was what it was. I wouldn't say that I want to go back there anytime soon, but it was definitely a good boot camp to kind of get yourself prepared for what you might have to deal with. And I did some IT for nonprofits. And then I started my own gig back in March of 1999. So we've been doing this for about 16 years. And what I really focus on these days is helping out individuals, small and medium-sized businesses with anything from something as simple as a break-fix issue all the way going up to, you know, turnkey IT solutions, mechanically invasive data recovery, recovering from hacks and other messy stuff like that.
Oh, wow. Yeah, you definitely cover the gambit of things, that's for sure. All right, very cool. Well, wow, 5 years old, Commodore 64. You had the 128 version, okay. I remember I had an original Commodore 64 in I really enjoyed that machine. I had 2 5-and-a-quarter-inch drives, and I used to copy all my games. So,
oh yes,
that was always fun, and it was fun to learn, you know, to learn how to do that stuff, you know, even back then. So, but yeah, things are a little simpler nowadays, I think, in some respects.
In some respects, definitely. I mean, you definitely don't have to get into the guts of your computer anymore. And I think because of that, I got very interested in Linux because I still craved it. I still wanted to get under the hood and kind of figure out how things worked. And so when I was about 15 years old, I downloaded my first version of Slackware. I think it took about 15 floppy disks, and it probably took the better part of 2 days over an AOL dial-up connection. But man, once I got it working, it was amazing.
Oh, that's cool. That's very cool. All right. Sounds good. So now we were talking about your website a little bit earlier, and you said you basically have two facing websites, and you're in the Washington, D.C. area?
We are. So we do Invescent.com. That's Envescent.com. That's our IT solutions company for small and medium-sized businesses. So when you load up the site, you'll see that we're really focused on offering IT services, data recovery, web design, search engine optimization, and information technology and security services in general. We also are starting to roll out some training services for clients that are eager to have that kind of one-on-one help that they might need to fill in some knowledge gaps. So that's what Invescent investment's all about. And then on the client-facing side, we have another website called ArlingtonVAComputerRepair.com or Arlington, Virginia Computer Repair. And much as the name suggests, it's located here in Arlington, Virginia. And that's where we do a lot of our break fix and client-facing data recovery services.
Wow. Now, what was the reasoning behind going and having two different websites?
I think mostly, Jeff, the biggest thing that I wanted to drive home is that for the consumer-facing site, it's really just focused on the kinds of problems that they're going to get into. So it's very easy for them to get on the site, figure out what service they need, and then contact us. And then for the business site, because there's a much broader range of IT that a lot of companies use, I felt it would be good to kind of bifurcate the content. So on that site, the investment site just rolled out actually this month, and this was 6 months in the making and about 45 pages of total content. So there's some deep content in there. And that the focus there is to really basically impress upon potential clients that we've got a breadth of experience to offer, and you're welcome to learn anything you want just by going through our website and then contacting us through our help desk.
Oh, that's awesome. No, that's a great way to look at it. I'd never thought about, you know, actually separating the, you know, I mean, obviously there's similar businesses, but there's definitely some differences when you're coming, when you're talking about, you know, supporting business versus supporting, you know, residents that are at home.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah, I like both your websites too. They're very, you know, neat and clean, which I definitely appreciate today.
Thank you.
Not, you know, not a whole lot of, you know, fluff and stuff like that that's really not needed. It's kind of straight and to the point for, I think, what people need.
And it's also kind of representative of how we operate as a company. You know, when a client comes in, we're not going to try to upsell them on a whole bunch of things they don't need, whether they're a company or an individual. We just want to focus on what is it that you want to have done, and then let's try to beat your expectations of how that's going to work.
Oh, that's great. That is, you know what, that is so important to business nowadays, that, you know, that customer service and really taking care of the customer goes a long way. And I think the people in the industry that are doing that will be around for a long time. The people that aren't, well, they'll be here today, gone tomorrow.
I couldn't agree more. Yeah, that's a brilliant point. And actually, Jeff, you touched on why I opened up Arlington VA Computer Repair. And that really has to do with, I saw just a total lack of customer service in the area. You know, it was all the big box chains, and you know, I don't want to say anything too bad, but I just don't feel like they care for customers the same way that an individual can. There's just a high turnover rate, and there's not the kind of training. And, you know, folks like us, we really care about our clients, not just because we want to help them, but because also that word of mouth from a satisfied customer is the most powerful form of advertising you can ever get.
Absolutely. Yep. That goes a long way. Word of mouth is probably still number one of how, you know, how we get noticed out there, because as with traditional advertising, you know, if you're putting out flyers or anything like that, you're looking at a less than 1% return on that type of stuff. And it's like, but if you can get that where you've done somebody a good job and they say, hey, you know, if somebody's talking to somebody that needs their computer fixed, hey, I just had this guy or this gal work on my computer, why don't you check them out?
And, exactly.
You know, that's definitely the way it should work. So, all right, very cool. Well, why don't you go ahead and, you know, what types of things? I mean, obviously you do a lot. I mean, I'm looking at your website. You've got data recovery, laptop repair, computer repair, Mac repair, virus removal, IT support. I mean, you do a little bit of everything. Now, as far as like, you know, laptop repair and stuff like that, I mean, you probably tear the machines down and do what you need to do, right?
Yeah. We're pretty involved with break fix. I mean, we draw the lines in certain areas. We don't do a lot of soldered on power jacks. We don't do a lot of MacBook screen replacements or logic board replacements, but we do just about everything else. We also don't work on some of the portable devices like tablets and phones. But when it comes to laptops and desktops, you know, 95% of the time we're able to resolve the issue for our client. And if we're not, and they give us a call and we know just from the topic of the conversation, knowing the make, the model, and the description, if we can't help them, we're going to try to find somewhere that can.
That's great. I'll tell you, I ran into a situation actually earlier this week where somebody had needed a screen replacement on what I thought was a laptop. And when they dropped it off, after looking at it and actually ordering the wrong part, believe it or not, because, you know, we all do make mistakes.
It happens.
I'm looking at it and I go, this was one of those laptops that basically the screen comes off.
Oh, yeah.
And is a tablet. And I didn't realize it that before I say, I don't normally work on tablets or phones myself because I really don't like the glued on screens.
Yes.
But since I was already halfway into this one, I said, all right, Well, I can order a digitizer. The problem is on some of these laptops, phones and different things are easier to get here in the States. But in order to get some of these one-off laptops that have these digitizer screens on the front of them, you have to order them from overseas.
Right.
And that can be anywhere from 7 to 21 days. So I had to call the customer back and go, hey, it's going to be more than what I normally quoted you. And here's why. And here's what's going on. So I just ordered a kit from iFixit for pulling the screen off. So I'm looking at it. I'm going to dive into it. I'm going to replace this one. And it's one of the things that I actually might think about doing some of the mobile, you know, more mobile repair.
Sure.
Down the road, just because it's, it seems like a lot of machines, even the laptops, are kind of going that way.
Oh, yeah. I couldn't agree more. And we're also seeing just so many more touchscreens. And that, of course, like you said, with the digitizer, introduces more complexity and cost in the repair. And I think one thing that a lot of people don't know when they're picking up one of those devices is when this breaks, you're pretty much shelling out, you know, half to two thirds of the cost of your device to fix it.
Absolutely. And that, you know, I just had somebody that called me today and said they were looking for a laptop, and they were looking for one of these ones that wasn't the detachable tablet, but is the one where the screen will flip all the over all the way to the back.
Sure.
And it was a Dell 15.6, one of their higher end machines, you know, around $1,000. And it's in it. And I said, that's fine. And I was looking at it and I'm like going, and I'm looking at the digitizer in the front. I go, the only problem is, just so you know, because this particular one, even though it didn't detach, it still had that front digitizer. I'm like, if you drop this on the ground and it cracks, you know, these tend to be a little more expensive to fix, just so you're aware of that. I said, but I said, to be honest with you, I said, a lot of these machines, when you're paying for any type of laptop around $1,000, you're usually getting a better fit and finish, and they're a little more robust than the $300 plastic ones.
That's another good point that you raise also, is that sometimes you have that difference between the focus on quality and cost, and that really determines what kind of computer someone's going to get. If they go into Walmart on a Black Friday sale and buy a $250 laptop, they're going to have an entirely different experience than the someone who does a little homework and probably buys one that's about three times more expensive, maybe a business class Dell or Lenovo system. And that kind of also determines what that client might be willing to spend on repairing that computer as well.
Absolutely. Because here's the thing. On a lot of these laptops, whether you buy a $300 laptop or a $700 laptop, the screen repair is pretty much going to be the same price.
Exactly.
There's not getting around. So it's like, but a lot of people, because they buy the cheaper one, they go, well, I have to pay that much to get a screen repaired. You know, and yep. I try to tell them, I said, well, you know, don't knock it on the ground or don't step on it and you wouldn't have these problems. No, I don't tell them that. But, but you know, it's like it actually, those thoughts do go through my mind. But
it's hard not to be honest. I mean, you got to think about it, because it is a logical question. You know, you got to hire, you know, someone who has technical experience. It's going to cost money for labor and for parts. And, you know, I'm sure that you offer competitive rates. So we try to be as competitive as we can as well. But it's a $250 to $300 laptop. What do you want?
Exactly. Well, you know what? And a lot of times the way I get around explaining that is, I, regardless of what people pay, if people pay $300 for a laptop, a lot of times what I'll tell them is that, listen, there's three major components. And, you know, in today's day and age, you have the motherboard, the hard drive, and the screen, really. Mm-hmm. And it's in each one of those is one third of the cost. So anytime you're talking about, you know, fixing it and repairing it, plus getting the parts and all that kind of stuff, you're looking at pretty close to one third, maybe even a little bit more.
Right.
But, you know, I just explained to them, these are the three main components that this machine has to have to run. And if you crack the screen, I'm sorry, but that is a, you know, that is a third of it. So a lot of people, they understand and they go, yeah, you know, there was, they made a mistake and whatever, and you know, they got to pay for it, or they can go out and buy another $300 machine, but you have to make that choice, you know?
And actually, Jeff, that gives us an opportunity to segue into another area that has similar implications, but more in the virtual sense. And that is, you know, when someone has their hard drive fail, it's also a matter of kind of quantifying, how much is this data worth to me? And I get into the conversation with some clients, they're like, well, I only paid this much for the computer. And I have to kind of explain that, yeah, the computer's cost is totally separate from what you stored on it and the value you place on, say, your irreplaceable family photos, your last couple of years of taxes, and any other information that you might have accrued that you now need to get back from this damaged device.
No, that's a very good point. And speaking of that, so the data recovery that you guys do there at your shop, what, I mean, how deep do you go with that data recovery before, I mean, do you go as deep as you can, or do you actually have to send it out to, you know, some other company sometimes?
We do everything here all the way up to mechanically invasive data recovery. The only areas that we're not fully equipped to do are some of the newer solid state drives where everything's on one chip. And if that chip is damaged, you're pretty much in a bad situation. But in terms of getting data back from formatted drives, from drives with bad sectors or corrupted firmware, or drives that have mechanical damage like defective head stack or platter, we have a 90% success rate, and we're pretty competitive with the folks that are in this area.
Okay, that's very good. I would imagine that in the area you're in, it's probably, I'm just going to say this because, you know, it is Washington, D.C. area.
Right.
It's probably a little higher end than maybe some other areas in the country at this point.
I would say so. I think, just to get off topic for a second, but our economy is probably a little bit more in that bubble territory because of all the government spending. You've got a lot more going on in this area, 3% unemployment rate, so more disposable income. So yeah, it's definitely a different market than some of the areas outside of the Beltway and outside of Silicon Valley.
So that's great for your business, though. And I would imagine that, you know, with all the people out in that area that, you know, they have to, for a lot of their jobs, you know, whether it be in, you know, government or whatever, they have to have their working laptops, they have to have their working computers or for whatever they're doing.
Oh, absolutely. And telework is a big thing around here because we have miserable traffic problems, as I'm sure you've heard on national news. And so staggering workflow and having someone work one day a week at home is a big thing. And if that work at home computer doesn't work, then the policy is you have to take from your paid leave. So it's really important. And one of the biggest things that I try to drive home for folks that rely on their computer for work, whether you're self-employed or teleworking, is have a spare computer. Because when that panic situation comes up where your computer is blue screen or you dropped it off the couch and the screen breaks like we were talking about, you got to have a backup computer.
Absolutely. And it's one of those things that I don't understand sometimes. I'm like, there are people that they basically, their job is based off of that computer. And if the computer's not working, they can't work. And I'm like, seriously, you don't have something else that you can fall back on? Yeah, definitely a good point.
And it's a hard conversation to have at that particular moment in time.
Right. Oh, that's a bummer. So data recovery, laptop. Now, you said you don't do power jack repairs as far as the soldering on.
Yeah, a lot of them that I found, like, and the ones that we see the most often are the ASUS jacks. It just seems like they are designed to break off. And
yes,
found is that when you repair them, they break off pretty readily even after that. And there are some aftermarket jacks that can make it slightly better. But I've just gotten in the habit of saying, look, you know, we're not a company that's going to offer repairs that we can't stand behind. If we don't feel like this repair is going to last you and you're going to be satisfied with it for at least a year, then I don't want to offer that service. And so that's why we kind of got away from that. And also repurposed a lot of our soldering gear for doing the firmware repairs on hard drives where you actually have to extract ROM chips and swap them. So that's where we're putting our infrared soldering gear into now.
Okay. Very good point. Yeah. And I'm sure there's probably what I've seen lately is there's a lot less of those solder on potter, you know, power jacks versus just the plug-in ones.
Yes. And thank goodness.
Yeah. It is a good thing, except that a lot of time, the plastic post or the plastic, you know, cage that those sit in is usually pretty busted up. So generally, whether I do one or the other, whether it's a solder on one or, or the ones that you plug in, what I'll do is I'll take a lot of epoxy and just kind of build up a little retaining wall to kind of hold them in place and make them a little more robust. Back in the day, I remember I used to take the power adapters, and I don't understand why every company does not do this. And what I would do is I would chop off the end, go to Radio Shack when it was still, you know, around.
Yes.
And I would get a right angle adapter and I would solder it back in and, you know, put those back together and give it to the customer. Cause I'm like, you're less likely to bust your power jack out of here if this thing does fall on the ground and hit on the ground with this right angle, you know, jack. But it's amazing the companies that are still doing straight on jacks for those computers. I don't get it.
Yeah, no, I agree 100%. And the point you raised with epoxy, I do something very similar when we do a jack repair and the inside has been impacted. There's basically a putty that we use, and the putty turns to the consistency of basically concrete when it sets. And so we'll build, like you said, kind of like a little retainer in there and sandwich it in. And sometimes it's in situations where without that, you wouldn't even be able to put a jack in. It would just float around the inside of the computer. So that can be a lifesaver, because your alternative is, of course, replacing the bottom case on a computer. And that's a lot more labor intensive than a power jack replacement.
Exactly. And the, you know, they're expensive.
Yes.
You know,
yeah, if you can even find it.
And yeah, between the upper and lower, you're looking anywhere from $100 to $150 for, you know, basically the plastic base or the top cover. What was the name? What's the name of the putty that you guys use?
I could check on that if you don't mind me putting you on hold for a second. I could grab the container there. I don't have it on the top of my head, but it's a really interesting solution, because it actually looks it has a gray exterior and then it has a lighter gray interior. And you break off a small chunk of that putty and you mix it with your fingers. Doesn't have the best smell in the world, but plastics generally don't. And then you shape it into the mold of your power jack. You just basically put it in there. I like to cure it with the overhead lamp. It seems to go a little faster in doing that. And then usually within about 4 to 8 hours, that thing is not going to move again. So you got to make sure you get it right.
Oh, that sounds good. But still 4 to 8 hours of set time, that gives you a little bit of time to, you know, actually play around with it. Now, I'll tell you what, why don't you just, if you get a chance after we're done with this interview, just go ahead and send me a link for that. And then I will add it to the show notes so other people can find it.
Yeah, absolutely. Good idea.
Okay, great. All right. So, laptop repair. Okay. So what types of things have you been working on lately as far as, and I guess right now we'll talk about, you know, residential computer repair, break fix, that type of thing.
Sure. Well, one of the areas that we're seeing a lot more activity in is the really nasty malware. Just the crypto wall, its third iteration is out there in force. Other sorts of ransomware and redirect malware is coming out and really causing a lot of issues for folks. So one of the things that we do when we do the malware removal routine for our clients is we don't just remove the malware. We repair the elements in the Windows operating system that have been damaged or corrupted, get the latest security updates in, and then build out a new line of defense. And the problem is, you know, because of how long antivirus software has been out there, it's created this false sense of security that, hey, as long as I have my Norton, I can kind of do whatever I want. Everything's going to be fine. But what I found in the last couple of years of really looking at this is it's really about having a more proactive approach. And that is to say, you really want to prevent the malware from even, you know, having any interaction with your computer in the first place, because once it's already in, chances are it's too late. Chances are your antivirus software is not going to catch it in time before it infects the computer.
No, that's a very good point. And I'll tell you, that's one of the things I'm battling with right now is I'm looking for, and you might have heard it on the other shows, I'm looking for an antivirus in a internet security suite, because what I'm being told by some of the experts in the field is that in today's day and age, you need a little bit more than just the antivirus.
Yes.
The problem is I'm running into problems that I ran into 10 years ago. And that's, you know, firewalls not acting correctly, not, you know, blocking things that it shouldn't, or slowing things down to the point where it's basically unusable, even on a Core i7 32 gigs of RAM, you know, 250 gig SSD computer. Sure. So that really has to do with the, you know, the browser and, you know, video and all that kind of stuff. So it's tough, because it's really, how do you protect the customer in today's day and age with what we have available?
Go ahead.
I was going to say, so with that being said, what are you using for, you know, to protect your customers?
Well, the first thing that I like to do with a customer that's gone through this is I like to discuss with them the main risks, so we're on the same page as to how this could happen again. And so information is power here. You know, you can put on the best security package in the world, but if someone opens up that phishing attachment, or, you know, visits a site and clicks on a malicious ad and their browser happens to be vulnerable to whatever the payload is, it's all for naught. So I always like to spend about 5 or 10 minutes with every client, even if it's not a virus removal, even if it's just a brand new operating system, and just talk about the risks that are out there, emphasize that about 40,000 new iterations of malware are coming out every day, and that no single program can really keep up with that. So for one of the things that we do for our clients, because I've seen an incredible amount of malware coming through what are called malvertising campaigns or malicious ads, we put on ad blockers on whatever browser they're most comfortable with. We tend to prefer Chrome or Firefox, and that really cuts down the risks, especially because some of those adware or ad blocking plugins will let you subscribe to a list of known malware websites. And that can be really helpful. Another thing we like to use is Spybot Search and Destroy to immunize the client's computer against all the known rogue websites that are out there. Because once again, I find that the majority of malware interaction comes from the web. And either it's you getting directed to a website, an email directing you to a website, or a malicious ad. But if those sites are blacklisted, that's a positive step forward. Another plugin that I like to use that I think is a really valuable plugin is Web of Trust, because it allows you to gauge the reputation of a website before you even visit it. And I found the community's ratings tend to be pretty on point. You know, every once in a while there might be a false positive, but for the most part, it really stops a lot of potentially malicious situations. So the first component that we really like to harden is the browser. And other things, setting specific, like if you're in Chrome, you know, telling plugins to click to play rather than playing all the time.
Right.
That can be really helpful. Disabling the ability of plugins to get outside the sandbox, so if it's malicious, it can't take over the browser. And you know, Jeff, it's really interesting. Another thing that I've also seen is you might clean up an entire computer and they have a Google Chrome profile and it synced up some of the malicious plugins. And then as soon as you sign in again, they come right back on. So yes, you've also got to make sure you clean up the profile so those malvertising plugins won't cause the redirects to come right back in and reinfect the computer. And then on the antivirus side, I'm a big fan of Microsoft Security Essentials, because one of the things I see time and time again is folks will get malware because they let their product subscription expire.
Right.
So even Microsoft Security Essentials, it's kind of basic, but it does the job and people really like it because it's simple. They get their definitions with their Windows updates. It never expires, and the value of free is rather profound.
Yeah, people tend to like free. And as it is a basis, that's one of the things that I still put on today. If somebody doesn't want to pay for, you know, some of these other programs, the problem I'm having today is that I really want, you know, and I know there's not one product that does it all, but you know, things like I really liked, I was testing out Bitdefender, and I like some of the things on Bitdefender because, you know, like Web of Trust in different things, it would show you, it would give you check marks when you were doing a search by good links, and it would give you a, you know, a red X by bad links. And it was pretty accurate for things that I would have never even noticed, even though I'm not clicking on those things.
Sure.
A potential customer could actually click on some of those bad links. So it's one of those things where I'm trying to get to a point where I can go, hey, this is going to help protect you the best I can. But one of the things you said was you were talking about Spybot Search and Destroy.
Yes.
And I didn't even know that was still around.
They actually released a new version. Spybot 2 is out. It's been out, I think, since mid last year.
Okay.
And it's actually really nice. I know the old version had a kind of esoteric interface and it turned off a lot of folks from using it. This one has a menu system where it's broken out so that you know what to do to update, to scan, to immunize. It's all broken out into different functions. And I find it to be a lot more intuitive, especially for folks that aren't as familiar with these kinds of programs. So for my home users and even for my business users, if they want more aggressive protection, I'll load on Spybot, especially if they're here for a malware removal. And we'll have the resident kind of running and doing its web browser protection, but we'll also have that immunization against all the known rogue websites. And when you combine that with Adblock and Web of Trust, chances are that clients won't even be able to get to the sites that they shouldn't be. So it ends up affording them a layer of protection that a lot of the other products out there don't seem to be as aggressive about.
Gotcha. No, that makes perfect sense. Now, what about the only other avenue, and to me, in my opinion, the biggest avenue that people are getting infected from is links in your email?
Yes. That's a huge problem. Go ahead.
Is there anything out there that you found that will actually work? Now, I know, you know, Bitdefender has its own plugin because I use Outlook. But as far as, you know, like webmail and stuff like that, I don't know anything that actually has something in there that can protect you from that per se. I mean, obviously, there's going to be things in the browser and stuff like that. But does it protect people? Because I still think that a lot of people are getting these crypto wall viruses through email links.
Yeah, that seems to be one of the big places. In fact, I just had a client come in this week that had CryptoWall on their computer from a malicious email link. So that's one of the areas where we see it originate quite often. In terms of protection, you know, it depends on a couple of things. Like if you're running Outlook or Thunderbird and you're rendering your email right there in the client, and if you click on the link and it actually opens up in that same client, you're offered less protection there. There's less you can do from a malware that might be coming in through that route. Whereas if you're in a browser and you're, let's say, running webmail, or your email client is set up to open links in an external browser, there's a little more control. But the biggest thing that I recommend to clients when they ever get anything in the email is if it's remotely suspicious, and that is to say it has an attachment or a web link, and you don't know that you can validate the source, call them on the phone. Say, hey, Tom or whatever, did you actually send me this email that says, hey, this is hilarious, click on this link? Get a little communication going.
Well, I'm going to tell you, if I get an email from somebody that says, hey, this is hilarious, check on this link, I'm absolutely deleting it right away.
Exactly. Oh. But, you know, there's some very convincing ones that have been coming out that'll say they're from Amazon or IRS or UPS. They'll have the authentic logo. They'll have all the verbiage. There's less and less typographical and grammatical errors. So it's becoming less easy to discern just by a glance whether this is the genuine article or not. So the other thing that one can do is, you know, they can look at the email header and quickly look at the origin. And if it doesn't match the company in question, it's probably not the genuine article. But in terms of your original question, what can we really do to, you know, help people not get affected through their browser? You're right in that there aren't a whole lot of ways out there. I mean, the main thing that you want to do is anytime, for example, you get an attachment, obviously, if you open the attachment, you're exposing your computer to it. But if you download it and scan it first and then open it, you might be afforded a better heads up. Like a lot of the attachments I see that are malicious payloads are actually PDF files. And people inherently trust PDFs. It's a document. What could it possibly do to my computer? And of course, in the advent of Adobe 10, they added JavaScript and all these bells and whistles that allow you to deliver malicious payloads with a PDF. So that's one of the areas where I say, you know, you've really got to be skeptical about PDFs, zip files, and of course anything executable, because those most often, especially if it's an unfamiliar origin, are going to be malware. And so it's about building in that initial skepticism, I think. A lot of the clients that I talk to after they go through this consultation, you know, they might get an email and I'll say, hey, forward it to me. I'll help you assess it this time and tell you what I'm doing and why I'm doing it, so the next time you have the skills to understand how to look at that email and say whether or not this is the genuine article.
Oh, that's great. That's a great service right there, because a lot of people, you know, a lot of times I'll get a computer in and one of the things I go, hey, see this little blinking icon down here that says, you know, there's Windows updates ready to be installed. And it's how long has that been blinking? Oh, I don't know, probably about 6 months.
Exactly.
I'm just like, you need to do those updates. And that's one of the things that's very hard to teach the customer how to do some of these certain things, because they always... they'll err on the side of, I don't know what it is, so I'm not going to deal with it, and I'm going to close my eyes, and hopefully nothing happens.
Yeah, you hit on a very important point there. I think the majority of malware infections start with outdated software.
Yeah. And, you know, now there's different varying opinions on here, but one of the things that my understanding, and again, I'm not a coder or anything like that, so I don't know all the intricacies of browsers and whatnot. My understanding is the Windows 8 desktop IE app, the modern app, is sandboxed in a way that it cannot, there's no way to get it infected and infect your system.
Well, so. They said the same thing about Chrome. And we have these hackathons, and in every hackathon as of late, all three browsers have been hacked. That's Firefox, IE, and Chrome.
Right.
So I'd say that Microsoft is definitely making strides in the right direction, but in doing so, they're really mimicking, as they have for quite a while, what the best of breed browser is doing at the time, and then trying to create that in IE. And it looks like they're actually walking away from IE. If I remember right, 20, 25 years later, they're saying, okay, we're going to retire IE, and they're bringing out something I think called Spartan.
Right. Yep. That's supposed to be coming out. Now, they're not actually getting rid of IE because they absolutely can't. But because I still have customers who they're still on IE8 because I can't upgrade them, because big corporations like Chrysler will not update their systems and they can't work with anything other than anything higher than IE8. So
That's a big problem in the government sector as well.
Yep. So it's still stuff we're dealing with, and I feel that we're going to deal with it for probably a long time to come. But I think so my understanding is the IE Modern app is different from the actual desktop app.
Okay.
And the way it's coded and the way it's done, basically, it's more of a sandboxed IE. The problem is most people don't end up using it because, not that it's not available, but when you install something like Chrome or Firefox, you cannot get to that modern desktop app anymore. All you can use is, or you can't get to the modern app. You can get to the IE desktop app. But in order to use the modern app, you can't have any other browsers installed. So,
interesting.
Yeah, it's an interesting conundrum. I think for most people that I know still use IE no matter what. And a lot of times I'll say, hey, do you want to try Chrome out or whatever? And they're kind of like, well, I'm used to IE. Oh, okay. Well, that's fine. You know? And so I think I'm going to try to, with some of my customers, and I've done it with a few, I'm going to try to get them to use that alternate, modern app and see if that helps them any better.
Sure.
And, because again, I don't really know of a way to really protect the customer when it comes to a lot of these things. I mean, there's always best practices, but the customers, a lot of times, they're not going to do those best practices. So we can inform them, we can teach them, we can try to make it better, which is, part of our job, which is good. But at the same time, it's like, I wish there was a magic bullet that I could just install on a system and go, here you go.
Well, there is one, and it's probably a real bullet through the system such that it doesn't work anymore, because if it doesn't work anymore, it's impermeable. It's secure.
There you go. Good point.
Yeah, Jeff, I agree with you. There's no doubt about it that it's frustrating to find ourselves kind of boxed in where we have to rely on not one best-of-breed solution, but really cobble together a variety of available solutions to try to help people. And then it's really at their behest as to whether or not they're going to go through with the steps necessary to keep those solutions running so they're kept secure. And that is definitely an ongoing conundrum. And it extends not just from the consumer desktop side, but all the way to the business server side, because I see the same habits causing problems. Whereas, how long has it been since you updated your production Linux server? Has it been a week, a month? Are you still vulnerable to Heartbleed from last year? And that becomes a big problem. And we've actually helped a lot of clients where, unbeknownst to them until it got really bad, their server or their server farm had been compromised by third parties, and they're using it for file sharing. They're using it for distributing all kinds of nonsense. And we got to get in there and clean it up and then explain what happened and then how to prevent it from happening in the future. So this issue permeates all the way to the commercial and government side as well.
Now, those things that were compromised, those weren't Linux servers though, right?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, they were.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Linux is a great operating system. Don't get me wrong. By default, it's definitely more secure than Windows. But the problem is that if you don't update it, back in the day, we were all kind of amazed at things like SQL Slammer. Look at this giant automated attack crippling the internet and going through and attacking automatically and injecting code automatically all these servers. And now that kind of stuff is just common. Every day, you look at your log on your internet connection, and if you look at your firewall, there's attacks every 2 minutes that are automated. Well, the same kind of thing is happening against Linux, where you'll see worms and other automated scanners trying to get in over vulnerable versions of Secure Shell or SSH, which you use for remote command line access, or vulnerable versions of the PHP scripting language, or vulnerable versions of the Apache web server, you name it, or even OpenSSL, which was a big deal last year and is actually coming into the mix again this year as they audit it and release a number of patches to secure it. So don't get me wrong. I think if you have a properly configured Linux server and you keep it up to date and you close down the unnecessary services and lock down the permissions, that thing is going to be a lot better off than a comparable Windows server. But that being said, if you don't maintain it right and you don't lock it down, you really are asking for it. And there's plenty of people happy to provide that malware for your Linux machine.
No, that's a good point. And it's one of the things I've always believed in, is that a lot of these operating systems, we think about it. Why is it that they write, updates? Why do they make updates? And you have to look at it and go, because there's problems, whether it be security vulnerabilities or, something's not working with hardware a certain way or whatever. But the reality is, every machine, no matter what operating system it is, has to be patched. And
Yes.
I could almost say the same thing about Windows servers. Now, I can't say it for the workstations because people do dumb things on workstations. It's just the way it is. But for servers, if you have that server updated and it's modern and you're keeping, you know, again, a lot of the things locked down on it, you can have a Windows server run just as good as I think as any other operating system, in my opinion. But like you said, they all need to be updated. They all need to be, you know, taken care of and, you know, kept safe, really.
Yeah.
So,
and one of the things that I think a lot of administrators find themselves in a conundrum, because on the one hand, they don't want to get hacked, but on the other hand, they don't want to install the update that breaks everything.
Exactly. And it is rough. So, you know, what's a good time, speaking of that, what's a good time period for, you know, and how much testing do you have to put into systems that you've been working on before you can do an update on that system? Or, I mean, is there a time period where you test it out on certain things? Because I know some of the bigger companies, you know, they'll spend a month or so testing it out, making sure that everything works before they actually put it into the environment.
Exactly. And I think that's really important, is to have that kind of workflow where you have a development server with all the same kind of components that you run on the production server. You run your updates through the development server. You make sure that you basically test every single component in order to determine that its performance is as good, if not better, that it's completely stable, and that any security issues that you've patched have in fact been addressed. If you can go through those metrics and say, okay, everything looks good, then, and that's what we tend to do here, then we'll push out the update during the twilight hours, where if it doesn't go quite right, no one's going to notice.
Gotcha. No, that's great. So is it easy to go back if that update actually breaks something that makes the environment unusable?
In Windows, yes. In Linux, you know, that's really one of the reasons that I love to keep backups. And I do image backups, and then I do database dumps and directory rsyncs nightly. And so that way, and it's all differential. So that way, if something does go wrong, we can roll back to the previous backup and be back up and running in a pretty short period of time.
That's a great point. Now, what types of backup services do you use?
Well, I tend to do my own kind of homebrewed backup. And what I mean by that is I'm very skeptical of trusting a cloud with sensitive information if it isn't heavily encrypted first. And so what I like to do is create an archive, encrypt it, and then shoot it over to Google and Amazon, so that that way that archive exists on their servers, but not in a form that they can access it.
Okay. That's a good point. Yeah, I never thought about that. Okay, so that's good. And then, I mean, obviously, you know, a lot of people are using a cloud now. Obviously, a lot of people are also using, you know, local backups, you know, on external, either external drives or even, you know, sometimes internal drives. I believe there's still a lot of people that are still using tape backups nowadays.
Yes.
You know, and like I said, I've said in the shows before, but if tape backups are done right and you have the people actually changing tapes properly and getting them where they need to go, then, you know, they work great. But if you don't, then you could have some problems.
Yeah, absolutely. And I find that really with any backup system that one implements, as long as they affect what steps are necessary to keep the system going, like, for example, a lot of my small business clients, they don't have a lot of money to invest in a backup system. Same with the home gamers. So we'll look at, hey, first, let's get you an external hard drive. Let's set that up with some kind of differential backup, whether that's Time Machine on the Mac side, or whether that's something like Create Synchronicity, a great free program for backing up on the Windows side. And then if they want an extra layer of redundancy, we can add in a second external hard drive and say, hey, once a week, take one of your drives, put in your fireproof, floodproof safe, and take that other drive that's a spare and attach it to the computer. And then if something happens, you'll only be a week behind. If something happens that knocks out your computer and the drive attached to it, you won't be very far behind. And those things can happen, whether it's a pipe that bursts above your computer or a crypto wall that comes in and knocks everything down and encrypts everything attached to your computer. You'll still have that other backup. So that's plan A. And then plan B is for anything that's not sensitive data, you know, something that if it gets out there, like your tax returns, et cetera, you know, anything like that, I don't encourage clients to put in the cloud, because sometimes it rains and you don't want that to be your taxes going out there to everyone that wants to steal your identity, for example.
Gotcha. Okay. Very cool. Well, it sounds like you got your own little system put together that's working for you and your clients. And, you know, again, our job is to keep the clients safe, you know, to the best of our ability. Obviously, everything is not 100% bulletproof, but I like the extra steps that you're taking with encrypting the data before moving it up to the cloud. So that's good.
Absolutely. And actually, that's something that we offer our small business clients as well, is, you know, if they're uncomfortable affecting their own backup solution, we'll back them up to our resources, and then our resources get backed up there. And, you know, there's a lot of comfort knowing that, hey, there's three or four copies of your data, no matter what happens. If your office, you know, burns down or the whole DC area has some kind of event, we still have it out there somewhere. You'll have your data. You know, worst case scenario, it just might take a little while to get it back to you.
Very cool. Now, what types of encryption are you using, or what types of encryption software are you using to encrypt these files?
Well, usually when we're doing this kind of backup encryption, we're going to be using the encryption tools that are built into Linux. So we'll use like GPG, and we'll use some of the things like Descryptor to be able to encrypt that data. It depends on what kind of data it is, how large, and if we're automating the encryption or if it's something where it's being done manually. So for the automated stuff, I tend to use some of the command line tools, and then I'll set up a private key so it'll encrypt on the fly. And then for the manual encryption or for whole disk encryption, I tend to use tools like Descryptor because, as we know, TrueCrypt is no longer a viable option.
Right. Unfortunately. My understanding with the TrueCrypt is they're still doing the audit on it, but I haven't heard anything back within the last, you know, month or so. So we'll see what they find out. But yeah, I think it's still got everybody gun shy from actually using that. And, you know, my standpoint on a lot of that stuff is, you know, a lot of people will say this is safer than this. And I go, it's software. Anything is breakable. And, you know, if somebody built in a back door and you don't know it and you're not checking the code yourself.
Right.
It's always a possibility. But yeah, no, that's cool. Now, let me ask you this. I think we'll move on from, you know, you do a lot of different things, which is really cool. What are some of your favorite tools, you know, software or hardware that you absolutely use in your business on a, you know, regular basis?
So for the residential side, you know, every case starts off with diagnostics because we want to wrap our heads around what's actually wrong. So I like to use tools like Pendrive Linux, where you can consolidate a lot of your valuable resources into one USB drive. So for example, you can spin out a USB drive with Pendrive Linux that'll have the Ultimate Boot CD and all the diagnostics it has built in, the Linux Mint Boot CD and all the tools that it has built in, the Bitdefender Boot CD for removing your malware, and then you can have things on the partition on the drive, like your Ninite.com installer for installing your applications, your basic requisites, or your antivirus software, depending on what kind of case you're doing. And then things like Windows offline update, so that if a computer comes in and it has just a terrible amount of updates that it has to do, maybe it's never been updated before, that will allow you to just plug in the drive, say, hey, I want it to update, and automatically reboot during the update cycle, and you come back a couple hours later and it's all done. So I like to kind of just emphasize automation and efficiency and organization as kind of the key foundations of running a good business. And so the Pendrive Linux is one of the best tools out there for building your own computer repair toolkit. And I also like, you know, a lot of other tools, depending on what the case involves. Like for data recovery, you know, and I know some of these tools have been discussed before. Scott Moulton has that wonderful My Hard Drive Died podcast, which I think everyone should tune into because there's just so much to learn. But things like TestDisk, RStudio, those are really great recovery tools, the former being a free one, the latter being a paid one, but a very versatile one. And then, you know, when you run into a client, and we're dealing with a lot more of this these days with the clients who use Microsoft Office Outlook, a lot of people are sending huge attachments, and Microsoft has these container limits, so they tend to get, you know, more and more corrupted as you grow beyond 4 gigabytes. I just had an Outlook client in here the other day. It had a 55 gigabyte PST file. There's a lot of room for corruption in that. So I actually really am a big fan of the Scan PST, Scan OST tools that are built right into Microsoft Office. They can be lifesavers when you're affecting a migration or a repair.
Okay. That's great. And, you know, I like Scott Moulton's philosophy on, you know, he uses many different pieces of software in his data recovery business. And the reason he said he uses all these different pieces of software is because he's like, I use whatever works for that job. And he goes, there's never one, you know, he prefers some over the others, but he goes, there's never one product that's going to get 100% of everything. So you have to have these different things that you're using. I'm going to definitely check out the Pendrive Linux again. I know I had set it up way back in the day and, you know, maybe a few years ago. I guess it wasn't that far back in the day. And, you know, I was using some of that stuff. I am still, believe it or not, and I get away with this now, but it's coming to an end soon, I can get away with using my disks.
Oh, sure.
And so I use a lot of disks when it comes to doing, you know, tools. But there are machines coming now with no drives in them.
Yes.
So I either have to get an external drive or I have to get really, you know, comfortable with using, you know, some of the different USB, you know, tools.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to touch on the point you made about Scott, I'm of the same philosophy that there's never going to be one tool that will do every job in any area, whether you're talking about information security, you're talking about putting together a website for a client, you're talking about cleaning up a specific kind of malware, or talking about recovering data. You've got to find the best of breed solution for that particular scenario. And that also brings up another point when you're talking about boot disks. What are we going to do with Windows 10? They're going to be locking us out. Everything is going to be secure UEFI boot. That's the spec that Microsoft's putting out there. So with Windows 8, it was kind of opt out. You could go back to the classic boot mode, legacy boot, as it's called in a lot of BIOS, and you could boot your diagnostic tools and all that worked fine. But if everything goes to the secure boot and there's no way to opt out, first, you can't load Linux. But more importantly, we can't run our tools on a lot of these cases.
Yeah, it's going to be unfortunate. Now, what I'm hoping is that the manufacturers, I'm hoping that there's a lot of people out there that are pushing back on this enough. See, it's not going to affect end consumers because they don't really care. They're just going to go buy an HP, Dell, whatever computer. But for us that are buying all these, you know, different computers and stuff, I think hopefully if we push back a little bit, they're going to go, you know what, we need to open this up and we need to have it. But, you know, you look at things like, you know, Microsoft talked about having Windows 10, you know, that you could load on an Android device.
Right.
Well, now Google's got it in their EULA that you can't do that. It's against their law.
Right.
And it's like, okay, are we really going to fight back and forth? Again, this is not the best thing for the consumers, and we need to use our tools. And let's face it, a lot of times Linux tools are the best tools for doing what we need to do outside of that Windows environment that's either broken or corrupted.
I agree 100%. And that's the really unfortunate tragedy. And then as we go more and more down this this path, I feel like with subsequent versions of Windows, Microsoft is kind of taking away some of the tools that we were able to use to repair. Whereas with you know, Windows 7, there were some more elegant in-place repairs. You could take your CD in, as long as your computer still booted, just remove any incompatible software, and you could do an in-place repair right over Windows 7. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, it works really well for anything that SFC scan and check disk can't fix. But with Windows 8, it's basically like, look, if you can't do an SFC scan or a DSIM, you know, image repair, then you've got to do a refresh install, and that's going to wipe out all your clients' apps, and they're probably not going to be delighted to find that.
No, and you know what? What I've found is in doing those that it's just better to go and reinstall the system.
Yeah.
Do a fresh install and go from there. Now, I am curious, though, and this is kind of off topic, but
sure,
with all the Windows 10 updates that they're going to be, or actually allowing people to, whoever's on Windows 7 or Windows 8 can update automatically to Windows 10, those computers are not going to have secure boot enabled 100% of the time. So it's just going to be new computers coming out. I hope they back off on that decision, because I think they're going to make a lot of people's lives very difficult when it comes to repairing these machines. And we'll definitely have to find other ways to go in and repair those machines. And because I don't want to get into a day and age where, you know, our whole business is based on nuke and paves.
Right.
I hate doing those because they take so long.
And it's just not very efficient. I mean, if there's a way to repair it, I'd like to repair it. And the geeky curiosity in me wants to be able to break it and fix it as well. So I feel like one of the things that'll work to our advantage is some of the commercial Linux distributions are actually being able to do those secure boots. Red Hat's doing it. I think Ubuntu's already doing it, or got some some projects in place to make that happen. So that works in our favor. But the other thing we have to ask ourselves with this is, you know, with every other release of Windows, it seems like Microsoft makes a terrible error. And then with the subsequent release, they correct that error. So I hope that with Windows 10, they maintain that course. Whereas, you know, ME was a disaster. XP was pretty good. Vista was a nightmare. 7 was great. 8 wasn't so great. And now we have 10. I don't know what happened to 9. Rumor is that 7, 8, 9, I'm not sure. But with 10, you know, I really hope Microsoft can get their act together, because they're losing a lot of market share to Apple only because people hate Windows 8 and they don't like the tiles. And that's something I'm hearing. You know, I didn't hear this as much in November 2012 and the months that followed the initial release. But these days, I hear a lot more feedback from clients that they just really don't like Windows 8. Now, one tool that I recommend everyone checks out is Classic Shell. ClassicShell.net allows you to install the start button, start menu, and revert the client's default login destination to the desktop, which is extremely handy for those Windows 8 users that just don't want to relearn the entire wheel.
Yeah, you know, I've had a problem because I love Windows 8.1. Windows 8 definitely had its problems, but Windows 8.1, I think, fixed all those. Part of the problem is I've ran into several issues with Classic Shell where it's actually broken things like iTunes.
Oh, wow.
There, you know, people will click on, you know, and maybe that wasn't the sole problem, but all I know is when I uninstalled Classic Shell, the problem went away. The shortcut was fixed. iTunes worked properly again. And so I get a little nervous when I put these third-party apps on these machines, because I used to run, you know, some of the, I can't remember the name of it, back when Windows 8 first came out, there was one from... I can't remember the name. Anyways, there's one that I actually bought. I paid like $5 for it, and it worked out perfectly fine. But then as the operating system started going on and there was updates to certain programs, all of a sudden, certain programs weren't working right. So again, the fix was I uninstalled it. All my stuff worked. And so I get a little nervous when I put those on customers' machines, because I go, okay, this was not written originally for this. It's sitting on top of what's already there. And I don't know if my customer is going to call me back, and then I've got to basically take care of them for free because I've installed it and said, no, this is the greatest thing since sliced bread, and you'll love it.
Yeah, that's definitely a crucial consideration. So, you know, with stuff like that, we tend to test it on multiple platforms. We test it on 8, 32-bit and 64-bit, 8.1, 32-bit and 64-bit, and then the latest patches the same way. I haven't had those issues, but anytime I have had an issue with Classic Shell, the developer has been incredibly kind with his time and very responsive. So any bugs I've pointed out, he'll fix and release an update within the week. So I've been really impressed with that project. That's why I wanted to give him a bit of a shout out, because it saved a lot of my clients some serious headaches.
Oh, no, that's very cool. And I will tell you that, yeah, all these people that are doing these third-party things are, I know they're updating them on a regular basis, because if they're not updating them, obviously they wouldn't be around. But because they're updating them, it's just that in-between time. It's like, you know, what do you do? So I guess, yeah, for the most part, now I've taken some of my customers and I've actually taught them the Windows 8 system. You know, with Windows 8.1, hey, hit your Windows key, and this brings up your huge start menu that you can look at, and you can click on these huge icons and set it up however you want. And most people, to be honest with you, are fine with that as long as they can get to their apps,
right?
You know, whatever they're running. And, you know, obviously, they're still running 100% desktop apps. They don't even really care about the modern apps, so it's not even an issue. I will tell you, I installed Windows 10 on another drive on my machine, and the first thing that I shut off was that stupid hybrid menu that they put in there, because I couldn't stand it anymore. I'm like going, okay, I'm getting older and I cannot look through 200 file folders of things that I have installed on my machine. I can't do it. It's ridiculous. So, but I can hit my Windows key and I've got all my icons put the way I like them, to where I can find an icon and click on it within, you know, 0.2 milliseconds and I'm happy. You know, so that's, I think it's one of those things that, you know, eventually it's rough because people are used to doing things a certain way, but hopefully going forward, people are going to learn new things and new ways to do things. And, you know, I think you've hit the nail on the head. After a couple iterations, Yeah, people get used to it.
yeah, by choice or by habit, we do definitely right. acclimate. And it's 25 years of Windows workflow that we're really having to kind of break away from and say, hey, let's do it this way now. And I think that's the biggest thing, especially when you're looking at, you know, places where productivity and workflow are critical at the end of the day, when you're talking about accountants and lawyers and engineers. You know, the Windows 8 interface is really tough to get back to the normal workflow that you're used to. And so I'm glad to see Microsoft with Windows 10 take a step back and say, hey, look, we'll let you kind of decide the user experience right. that you want to have.
And that's what it comes down to, is having that choice. They should have always left that choice in there. And I think they kind of helped a little bit when they went to Windows 8.1 by allowing you to, you know, log into the desktop, not log into the modern apps. And I think that kind of helped people there. But one of the things that I've noticed is I grew up with a mouse and keyboard.
Sure.
And a mouse, really, in today's day and age, if you talk to any of the old timers, a mouse is so inefficient as far as I've got to drag it across a 30-inch screen and find what I need and click on there. I wish I would have learned more of my keyboard shortcuts, because you can be so much more efficient in a Word document or whatever you're doing, that, you know, copy and paste, all that kind of stuff, instead of the whole right click, left click. You know, it's just, it is so inefficient, and we've just gotten so used to it that we don't really know any different. So I kind of like what you said earlier, is, you know, one of the things you went into Linux for was because you could get back into that deep, you know, deep part of the operating system and do some things that you like to do and kind of be geeky with it. So I think when it comes to Windows, they make it so easy that it's just like, hey, just point over here and click, and that's all you got to do.
And I think we get a little spoiled with that too.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, I feel the same way, that having the keyboard shortcuts can really improve workflow, especially on some of those applications where, you know, you've got to have your mouse free for what you're doing there, and then you're going to be using those shortcuts to do more of the entry part of it. And I'm also really excited to see more of like optical tracking as a way of moving the cursor around, being able to have a dialogue with the computer where voice recognition actually works and understands what you're saying, and will allow you to, you know, basically have a constructive dialogue with the computer. Those kinds of technologies are not that far away, and I think that it's really going to revolutionize the way we use computers, whereas now we're sitting in front of the computer and we're kind of huddled over it. In the future, I think computers are going to be kind of traveling more with us, and mobile technology is paving the way for that, where we'll have a computer that's just as powerful as our desktop, but we'll be able to carry it around in our pocket, and when we need to use it like a desktop, we can either have it plug into the traditional interfaces, or perhaps even have its own projector. But I'm really excited about the way that technology is going in that sense, because I feel like finally we'll be able to untether. We'll be able to have the useful, productive elements of a computer, but we won't be tethered to an office chair.
Yes, but will I be able to play Battlefield?
Oh, you know it. There's got to be some way to game, because us PC gamers were insatiable. So I'm sure there's going to be ways to game. And I'm sure that what we're really waiting for here is being able to have a mobile device where the battery life isn't only a couple of hours if you're doing something intensive on it, and then being able to have a mobile device where the performance is comparable with a desktop system. And those two things are really the biggest obstacles. Without those two hindrances, though, you could conceivably play Battlefield on some of the higher-end phones.
Oh, absolutely. And I think the hardware, as far as that goes, is there. I think you hit the nail on the head, though. The battery life is the one thing that nobody, for whatever reason, has cracked yet.
It's miserable. Yeah. I mean, we've had the same technology, lithium-ion batteries, for like 10 or 15 years. They really haven't gone very far. So I'm really excited to see the next generation of energy storage
right.
and the next generation of how we're going to be recharging our devices. If it's wireless, that's pretty liberating as well, because I feel like that's one of the biggest constraints. And, you know, if you're someone who has like an iPhone, for example, when your battery runs out, you're done. You
right.
really can't do anything.
Absolutely. No, that's why I still will always buy a phone today that I can swap the battery out, because depending on where I'm at, I always carry, you know, a couple extra batteries with me. And even though my battery lasts pretty much the whole day, I do get sometimes late into the day where it's like, let me go ahead and, you know, I've got 10% left or 5%. Let me go ahead and swap this battery out, so I've got a full charge and I continue to do the things that I like to do. So.
What a luxury to have.
Yep, exactly.
I'm the same way, Jeff. I travel with three batteries, one on the phone, two out, because I never know when I might need those extra batteries. And I have clients coming to me all the time for meetings. They're like, can I just, you know, plug in, just jack a little juice just enough to get me home? Sure, be my guest.
Oh, that's funny. Yep, yeah, people get used to it. They don't want to do that plugging in. But yeah, they are coming out with a lot of nice things with the wireless charging and stuff like that, where you can charge within, you know, 15 feet of a device and in different things. So I think we are getting there. It's just to the point of, yeah, the battery technology has got to get better, and somebody's got to crack that, you know, that process.
And I feel like we've been looking at it from the opposite angle. It's like, hey, how can we make this chip use less power, or how can we make this memory use less power? Not how can we store more power?
Right. Exactly. More power in a smaller footprint.
Yes.
Very cool. All right. Well, I'll tell you what are some of your business tips that work for you and your business?
Well, I think the first thing for anyone that wants to get into doing technology, whether it's for home or business users, you've got to be willing to really go out to the extra length to make the customer happy. You really want to focus on that high quality customer service, so you get that repeat business, so you get your referrals, and so that you can also make sure you're making people happy, because, you know, that should be the reason why someone is aspiring to get into this. If you're getting into it to just make quick money or some other nonsense like that, that's not really this field is about. I really feel like the people that do well in this field are the people that have the dual talent of having some technological expertise and having good people skills. And that's what I would say, is really focus on your weak spots. Identify what it is that you're not doing well, if there is one of those areas, and work on it. There's great classes out there to enhance our communications, just like there's tons of free content on the internet to learn anything and everything about technology. So that's the first point. The second point I'd say is design a good quality website so that when a client reaches it, they know exactly what you're about, that they can build some trust in your company, and so that they can learn more about your services and contact you through that same website. And then the third thing that I think is really important is to make sure that when you're interacting in the pre-sales sense, you don't have to give away the whole shop, but try to honestly give a little extra. Try to help people. Like, I'll have people call me and I'll know that just by the virtue of the nature of their call, it's either something where it's not worth it for them to pay me to help them, or it's something where I can't help them because of the nature of the problem. So I'll still try to take 5 or 10 minutes out of my day to direct them. Like, I had a client call me the other day and they didn't know where to buy an Ethernet cable locally. So I directed them to a couple different stores where they could buy it, tell exactly what kind of Ethernet cable they should buy, you know, a snagless Cat 5e. And they were really appreciative of that. And maybe they'll use us in the future for something that comes up. Maybe they won't. But I really feel that providing that excellent pre-sales customer service also builds trust in clients that aren't getting to you from a referral. They're just getting to you from like an internet site or something like that. And then the other thing that is really important, I think, is making sure that your process is straightforward, that you set expectations before you even engage in business with a client. You want to make sure that they understand how you work, you know, what you do, and therefore they get a sense of, well, how this process is going to work, what kind of feedback they're going to get, what the costs are going to be, and what the end result is going to be. Setting those expectations before you make a contract with a client can really help to avoid a nightmarish conflict if you don't do that and they have a different understanding than what you have. And that can also be done by having an effective contract, which I suggest everyone has.
Yes.
A good contract, because without that, there's not a lot of protection for you. Your business and your client might not know what they're getting into either.
Oh, very good tips. Yes, I agree wholeheartedly with all of those. That is really the nature of this business. So, well, I appreciate you coming out and sharing with us today. And yeah, thanks for coming on the show. And where can people find you at?
Well, they can find us on our websites, Envescent.com, Envescent.com. Also, our Arlington, Virginia computer repair website, which has a short link that's A is in Apple, V is in Victor, C is in Charlie, R is in Romeo, .us, AVCR.us. We have blogs on each website. I'm also a published author on Core Compass. I've got some articles coming out on Net-Security. That's the HelpNet security website. So I do a bit of writing on the side as well. And finally, people can follow us on Twitter. That's twitter.com/Envescent or twitter.com/ENVESCENT.
Excellent. Well, like I said, I appreciate you coming out and sharing with us today.
Well, Jeff, it's truly been a pleasure, and I'd be delighted to do it again sometime.
Absolutely. You're more than welcome to come back and share what's going on in your business. Very cool. All right. You guys can also find me on the Google Plus at Jeffrey Hallish or Twitter at TechNutPC. And if you have any questions or would like to be a guest on this show, like Alex, just email me at podnetsdaily@podnets.com. If you want to leave a voicemail, call 1-888-697-0162. And I want to thank our sponsor, Instant House Call, for this episode of Podnets Daily. And don't forget, if you guys need business paperwork to get you started in your computer repair business, then check out the link for the Tech-Enabled Computer Business Kit over at podnuts.com. Again, that'll have all your contracts and different things you need to get started in your business. And as Alex said, you need to have those good, proper contracts so you can set your customers' expectations. And if you guys could, please leave us a rating and review over on iTunes. That lets more people know about us. And you guys can help support the Podnets Network. The next time you're shopping on Amazon, go to podnuts.com/Amazon. And I want to thank everyone for listening and subscribing to the show. We'll see you next time on Podnets Daily. My name is Jeff Halish. I am the host of Podnuts, where Chris Carruthers and myself take live calls on the air to answer questions or to get answers from other computer repair techs every Sunday at 4 p.m. Eastern. You can check it out over at podnuts.com/live. Music provided by Steve Cherubino at stevecherubino.com.